Greetings from the World Newsroom in Boston. This is the World's Technology Podcast. I'm Jason Margolis. The World is a joint production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. Back in Boston, after taking the podcast on the road for a week down to New York City, I hope you enjoyed that little jaunt experiment from the Wired Next Fest at the Javits Center. I was trying to give you a little feel for what the gathering was like. I hope our mission was accomplished. This week, back to our more standard format, if there is such a standard format for the podcast, but some really interesting and diverse topics on the podcast for this week. We'll start with a story about more efficient stoves being used in Darfur and the life-saving implications of that. A village in Italy, where the people there seem to be immune from certain diseases. A new recruiter from the U.S. Army. A very heavy piece about the unfortunate price we sometimes pay for technology. The exploitation of low-wage workers who make semiconductors. A global warming conference in Mexico. And we'll close with the smells of the New York City subways. Yes, you heard that correctly. The smells of the New York City subway system. Let's begin the podcast with the story about stoves. Here's an interview that the host of The World, Lisa Mullins, conducted with Christina Galitsky. Galitsky volunteers her time and efforts in the Sudan.
The fighting that's raged in Sudan's Darfur region for 3 years has created a massive humanitarian crisis. 2 million people have been displaced by the violence. Huge refugee camps have sprung up in Darfur. And those camps, firewood and security, are in short supply. Every day, women and girls have to wander farther and farther from the camps to gather wood for cooking. They're often assaulted by bandits who roam the countryside. Many of the women are raped. That tragic situation got Christina Galitsky thinking. Galitsky works at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. She does research on new energy-efficient technologies. Galitsky developed a few cook stoves for the girls and women of Darfur to try out. They chose one that worked especially well.
So the cook stove that was selected was kind of like a giant tin can, and you feed the wood inside the middle part of the tin can. The pot will sit on top. We actually modified it so that we have provided a windscreen because it's very windy there for about half the year. And then we added stakes that go into the ground so that it stabilizes the cook stove when they're cooking.
Now, you brought this to Sudan along with your team. When did you go there?
We were there last November, December, the first time.
And so you kind of unveiled the product, sort of like testing it out to see if they would like it or what?
Yeah, we unveiled 4 different versions of the stove. We wanted to give them a choice and sort of understand what types of things they were looking for in a cook stove. And
how did the different ones differ from design?
They differed in their shape and what they were made of and... Mostly that. We were looking for efficient stoves that were made of metal that could be fairly easily produced there. And the one we selected is the one that could be most easily produced in Sudan.
Tell me what it was like. I mean, you went in there to the refugee camp, and did you gather around a bunch of women, or was the word put out first? How did that work?
So we worked with an aid organization that was already on the ground there that knew the culture of the camps very well. And what needs to happen is you need to go and present your ideas to the community leaders. And then we did a demonstration. So we cooked with our stoves side by side along a 3-stone fire. And we piled up equal piles of wood in front of each of the 2 stoves. And we just showed them to cook their meals. Our stove used at least half or less the wood that their stove used.
So they were cooking on the traditional stove and next to you cooking on this cook stove that you had developed.
Yeah, actually they were cooking on their stove and we were cooking with them on their stove. So they were really cooking their meals on both stoves. We were just giving them guidance. And then they could just see as the cooking went on, the wood piles in front of their stove went down really rapidly and in front of our stove went down much more slowly.
And the difference is that there is less oxygen inside the can to be able to burn up the wood?
The difference is the ratio of oxygen. The oxygen is channeled more properly in the fire to completely combust the material instead of producing carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide and water.
One would think that that's a fairly simple idea. Had nobody thought of this before, or is it that these huge cans that you're recommending they cook in were not available?
I think it's a combination of things. There's so many problems going on in that region that, and people are fairly strapped for how much they need to do. You know, they need to get them food, they need to put up shelters, they need to do all these things, get them clean water. There's just not enough personnel there to solve all the problems. The other thing is, yeah, the stoves aren't available there. They're going to have to be manufactured, and we're working on that.
So take us back to this experiment when you're demonstrating to them how much less wood your stove uses compared to the three-stone stove that they use at the three-stone campfire. Was there sort of an aha moment when they realized it, or did they kind of expect what was coming?
There was actually, at least in the first demonstration, there was an aha moment because our stove channels energy so much better than a three-stone fire. The onions that they were frying sizzled so much more quickly. So there actually was an aha moment. It was a strange feeling. I felt a bit like a magician.
Christina, when you graduated, where did you graduate from with your degree?
Graduate school Berkeley.
At Berkeley. Did you see yourself doing humanitarian work with your degree? I mean, how did you even move into this area?
No, I left school with a master's instead of a PhD because I was dismayed at sort of traditional, what I thought of as traditional chemical engineering pathways.
Which would be what?
Working in more like product development or biotechnology or oil refining, something like that. And I guess I was more interested in environmental problems and social problems. So you called it humanitarian, same thing. I certainly didn't graduate thinking that I would be going to Darfur. I mean, that was a happy ending, I guess, or situation that I'm able to do that kind of stuff.
Christina Galitsky works at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. She has just received the Humanitarian of the Year Award for Innovators, given to an innovator in science and technology under the age of 35 for her work in helping to develop a more fuel-efficient cook stove for the women of Darfur, Sudan. Thank you very much. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Seems like a wonderful person doing a very good and noble thing. This next story is not the traditional technology story you've been hearing on this podcast, but I think it's very important. We live in a very postmodern world where we get the newest gadgets, high-definition TVs, smaller and smaller cell phones, better computers, everything faster, quicker. But there can be a price to be paid for this technology, and there's a human cost to all this. In California's Silicon Valley, many of the workers in high-tech factories are immigrants. Their jobs are often low-paying, and they sometimes involve work with toxic chemicals. Now, federal and state laws provide some worker protections, but what happens when a company picks up and moves to a country where workplace rules are less stringent? That's what happened with a California-based company named AXT. AXT makes semiconductors. California fined the company for exposing workers to high levels of arsenic. AXT decided to move its operations to China. We'll have a report from Beijing in a moment, but the story begins in California. I reported it this week on The World. 6 years ago, California's Occupational Safety Board handed down its second heaviest fine in its history. It cited the company AXT for willfully exposing workers to arsenic. Arsenic is a potent carcinogen and can also cause skin lesions and nervous system disorders, among other problems. It's a byproduct of gallium arsenide, which AXT uses to manufacture semiconductors. Most of AXT's employees were Chinese immigrants. Today, many are in failing health, without medical care and unable to work. 65-year-old Wei Ying Wong lifts up the side of her shirt and points to several large red splotches on her abdomen. She says she's often in pain. She feels itchy and her eyes are irritated. It's not possible to determine exactly what caused her health problems. But she and dozens of other former workers blame the chemicals they were exposed to at the AXT plant. Sheng Yang Liu is 61, but he walks slowly with a cane like a man well into his 80s. He says he was healthy before he began working at AXT in 1998. He says at the factory, ventilation was poor, and AXT didn't provide adequate protective gear or inform him of the risks of being exposed to arsenic. Sheng Yangliu says he knows the damage he's suffered, whatever it may be, is done. But he's telling his story to make sure no one else has to go through what he's gone through. California cited AXT for 42 separate violations in the year 2000. AXT paid some of the fines and appealed others. The following year, AXT began firing its factory workers and moving all of its manufacturing operations to its facility in China. AXT declined multiple interview requests for this story. It's extremely difficult to prove in court that exposure to a chemical might cause a future illness. Still, local immigrants' rights groups have been trying to get AXT to compensate former workers for close to 3 years. Vivian Chang is the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network in Oakland.
We have a situation where 500 workers, Chinese immigrant workers, were exposed to 31 times the legal limit of arsenide. At a bare minimum, what these workers are asking for is long-term medical monitoring. It's not an unreasonable request.
Shortly after this interview took place, Chang's group reached an agreement with AXT. The company provided some money for basic health monitoring for its former workers. As part of the deal, Chang's group agreed not to speak to the press or disclose specific details of the agreement. But before the agreement, Chang told us getting some compensation doesn't end this story.
It's bad enough that the workers have lost their jobs and are living under the shadow of cancer, but we've now got workers in Beijing that are also potentially facing the same situation. And AXT is not the only company that it certainly has uprooted the dirtiest part of their production facilities and moved to China.
But how to stop the problems from moving overseas as well is a challenge. Katie Kwan directs the Center for Labor Research and Education at UC Berkeley. Kwan says recent trade agreements have helped companies do business overseas. But with few exceptions, workers' rights have been largely ignored.
There needs to be global labor strategies that organize workers across borders in order for them to deal effectively with multinational corporations. You know, unions used to be the traditional force that deals with corporations and, you know, prevents corporate greed from taking over and protects workers and so forth. Well, if the world is global, then unions need to be global, too.
Labor rights advocates in California have been trying to contact and mobilize AXT workers in China. But so far, they've made little headway. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Oakland, California.
And I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing. It is here, in an industrial district in Beijing's eastern outskirts, that AXT set up its new plant 6 years ago. At quitting time, AXT's workers start to trickle out. This man asked that his name not be used. He says before he started working here a few weeks ago, he read on the internet about the health problems of AXT employees in the United States. He was worried, so he asked some of the AXT workers who'd been here at the Beijing site the longest if they have any unusual health problems. The reply, he says, was that the workers all felt okay. But he's still worried. He says he knows that the effects of arsenic exposure can take years to show up. He's not convinced that the paper masks, gloves, and gowns that the company provides, or the ventilation system it uses, are doing enough to protect him and the other workers. Workplace safety is an issue for many Chinese workers, says Robin Munro of the Hong Kong-based labor advocacy organization China Labor Bulletin.
You have very bad working conditions in the private manufacturing sector, where mostly migrant workers from the countryside are employed. The workers are no longer confronting the government as their direct employer, as they were in the old state-owned economy days. They're facing private entrepreneurs and capitalists.
Including foreign investors, at least some of whom are drawn to China not just because of China's cheap wages, but also because of its lax enforcement of safety standards and its lack of effective organized labor. Walmart has just been forced to accept chapters of China's official labor union among its workers here, but Monroe says the Communist Party controlled All China Federation of Trade Unions, or ACFTU, wasn't exactly set up to be an advocate for workers' rights.
The ACFTU's role traditionally, as given to it by the party, has been really to enforce labor discipline and to keep the workers quiet, to keep them happy, and this sort of thing. The ACFTU is failing to do that.
Monroe says the most effective way for China's official trade union to keep workers quiet and happy would be to act like a real union and actually advocate on behalf of workers. But that's something it can't easily do. Local governments tend to be so focused on economic growth that they don't want to allow worker activism that could discourage investors. Labor rights activist Liu Kaiming is based in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen. He says workers, and especially migrant workers, are at an inherent disadvantage in China.
Our workers cannot protect their economy and health. So that I think how to empower these workers. We have to build civil society and then let workers have power to protect themselves.
Such talk makes the Chinese government nervous. It has routinely shut down independent organizations that could potentially challenge its power, including independent labor unions. But at the same time, it has allowed China's courts to settle more labor disputes. The China Labor Bulletin has helped some mainland Chinese workers press their cases in Chinese courts and in arbitration. It says the workers actually win one-third to half the time. Han Dongfang, a former Chinese railroad worker himself, is the founder of China Labor Bulletin.
We are trying to educate people, to tell people that daily action, daily participation, that is very badly needed. And we are trying to urge people not to wait until the very, very end. You can't wait anymore and everybody explode.
The growing number of labor protests in China could be one reason the Chinese government announced this year it will shut down more than 35,000 factories that pose serious work safety risks. The government is also considering imposing harsher penalties, up to 7 years in prison, for employers whose negligence causes death in the workplace. But it's less clear what penalties for employers would be when factory workers' health deteriorates slowly after prolonged contact with toxic substances like arsenic. AXT officials in Beijing and in the United States declined to be interviewed for this story. The company instead sent a written statement. It said AXT is committed to the health of its employees. It said AXT's Beijing plant was certified this year as meeting an international environmental management standard. But the statement did not provide details on what AXT is doing now to monitor and limit arsenic exposures in the workplace, or how it's ensuring that its workers in Beijing don't meet the same fate that some of its California workers already have. For The World, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Beijing.
Global warming. This is a topic that is not going away. This week, ministers from the world's top 20 polluting nations were meeting in Mexico, working on finding a long-term deal for climate change. The Bush administration in the United States refuses to cut its emissions until big developing nations cut their emissions too. Developing countries say this is outrageous. The United States is the world's largest polluter. This week, a meeting in Mexico was arranged by the British and Mexican governments to try and break the deadlock. The BBC's environment analyst Roger Harabin filed this report from Mexico.
Mexico of the tourist cliché. 2 hours north of Mexico City, a tinny radio, a field of maize. A spectacular view across to the twin volcanoes of the Prince and the Sleeping Princess. Just down the road, a young woman with a baseball cap turned back to front is washing the courgette harvest, brought in by her family members with the help of two donkeys. But just across the road is a very different Mexico. An asphalt works, belching grey smoke into the clear blue sky. This country is industrializing fast. Emissions of CO2 are rising by 2.2% a year. What point cutting our emissions, the Americans say, when countries like Mexico are increasing theirs like this? Adrian Fernandez heads the think tank INE in the Mexican Environment Department. He admits that Mexico's emissions are becoming a global problem.
In the last 10 years, we have experienced an increase of more than 30% of our emissions. Most of the emissions are coming from the energy generation sector and energy use sector, and in particular from the transportation sector.
The American government says there's no point it cutting emissions while countries like Mexico are increasing theirs.
Well, when we look at the per capita emissions of countries like Mexico as compared with the U.S., there's no way there's a close comparison. A U.S. citizen uses three or four times as much energy as the one we use in Mexico. That doesn't mean we are efficient enough. We have a lot of room to improve, but the U.S. I think that has to look at the way they have been developed themselves, which is not in a sustainable way, and there's so much waste of energy in every single thing that the U.S. Citizens do.
It's a worry for Dr. Fernandez. Parts of Mexico are very vulnerable to climate change, and already the weather is going to extremes.
Extreme temperature, more hurricanes, more severe, more flooding in some places, but also some droughts in other parts. So we know that the weather seems to be changing in various directions.
But what to do? Mexico is driving headlong towards the American lifestyle, and emissions are rising to match. The Mexican people may comment on the strange weather, but that hasn't stopped a boom in gas-guzzling 4x4s. At an emissions testing plant in Mexico City, Toniatu Vasquez can see no reason to abandon his SUV.
This fashion was brought by the American people, sport utility vehicles. Of course, we try to adopt this fashion. You really feel like a powerful, and you are over the rest of the people.
So there's a mismatch between people's desires and government responsibilities, and the planet is suffering. The British government's jointly organised a conference with the Mexicans of the top 20 polluting nations, the aim to prompt rich nations to cut emissions now and developing nations to grow rich in a less polluting way. The talks include energy and environment ministers, and they're informal. The idea is to circumvent the entrenched negotiating positions struck by countries like the USA at the formal UN climate talks. The ministers will hear this week that tackling climate change is affordable, but will get much more expensive if we delay. They'll hear that ignoring the problem, then gambling that we can adapt to any change, is both unrealistic and immoral for the countries which will suffer most. Here in Mexico, though, there are glimmers of hope. In Mexico's huge central farm belt, these porkers are playing their part in the climate battle. Pigs produce methane, a potent greenhouse gas. But under a scheme funded through the Kyoto Protocol, the methane here is being captured and used to generate electricity, a double bonus. But Enan Mateos of AgCert, who are running the scheme, admits it's a drop in the ocean of Mexico's emissions.
That's correct. But it's a good effort, and it only shows how far we need to go.
Do you think ultimately farming will be regulated on its emissions of greenhouse gases in the way that industry currently now is in Western countries?
I think so. That's a world trend.
So moves are being made to salvage the climate, but many scientists are despairing that while politicians talk about the need to cut emissions, the emissions themselves are still rising fast.
Be all you can be. That was long the slogan for the U.S. Army. Now they have a more sophisticated, or shall I say technologically advanced, way to recruit. Take a listen to this interview I did with our host, Lisa Mullins.
Since the war in Iraq began in 2003, recruiting has been a challenge for the U.S. military. Last year, for instance, the U.S. Army failed to enlist enough new soldiers to meet its recruitment goals. To fix the problem, the Army decided it needed a new recruiter. Well, it got one. His name is Sergeant Starr. Sergeant Starr is not a real person. He's an avatar. An avatar is what computer people call an online graphic that depicts a person. The World's technology correspondent Jason Margolis is here in the flesh in the studio to talk about Sergeant Starr. Why did the Army recruit this man to begin with?
Well, many people who are thinking about joining the Army are young. They're 17 to 21, and they feel more comfortable doing things online. They've grown up with the internet. This is how they operate. So when I spoke with people at the Army, they say it's kind of like a buying a new car mentality. Maybe you're not quite ready to buy yet. You just want some information. So by doing this online, they can do it in the comfort of their own home. It's also a little bit less pressure. You're not speaking with an actual person face to face, so you can ask pretty much anything you want and not feel like a person is going to judge you.
Although when I went online to goarmy.com, you could talk to a real person if you wanted, but the Sergeant Starr, the avatar that you mentioned, is another option. I think we should try him out, Jason. What do you say?
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's have a look.
Okay, so now, okay. Guide us through this, Jason.
Okay, so you see right on the homepage right there, it says Meet Sergeant Starr. Okay. So just click on that.
Let's
see. And there he is.
Oh, he looks the part.
Yes, he's a chiseled man wearing a beret.
I think he looks kind of stern.
Hello, I'm Sergeant Starr, the United States Army's virtual guide. Please type your name below.
Okay, some.
Ooh, even first and last name. You're braver than I was.
Oh, really? Oh.
I don't know. I know I'm at my computer. I was still a little nervous because it was the military. I know it's totally irrational, but I felt that somehow they would know who I was.
Okay, it says in response,
welcome. How can I help you today?
Okay, well, you can. Let's see, what do I want to know from Sergeant Starr?
What if you asked him, will I get sent to Iraq?
Yep, that would be a logical first question for a potential new recruit. Will I get... Okay.
In times of war, deployment is likely. The possibility of deployment is dependent on your MOS and unit of assignment.
MOS.
All soldiers must be strong, trained, and ready upon assignment to a unit and prior to any deployment, including training exercises, humanitarian missions, or combat operations.
What is MOS, by the way?
That is an excellent question, Lisa, okay. One which I cannot answer.
Well,
maybe
let's
Sergeant
see if you can. What is MOS?
MOS stands for Military Occupational Specialty. This is the job that you will perform while in the Army.
Okay, Jason, what's your next question?
Well, I was trying to trick Sergeant Starr earlier, and he's much shrewder than I gave him credit for. So I asked him, I said, what is your favorite Jethro Tull song? I assumed he'd say Aqualung, but let's...
Do 18-year-olds know who Jethro Tull is? Well, let's say that's irrelevant. Okay, here we go.
Displayed below are answers that I believe are related to your question.
Ah.
And displayed below are, here's more, favorite place, favorite camouflage, favorite color.
So click on favorite place, see what he says.
My favorite place is at basic, turning a bunch of green recruits into a hardened fighting force.
Let me just get favorite food.
I'm partial to the Captain's Country chicken MREs. They're good.
Well, it sounds like he's got a bit of a sense of humor. Okay, Jason, we could ask questions of him all day, but how is this actually working? Is he helping with recruits or not?
Well, it's a little bit early to see how he's doing in the overall military's recruiting because he just started in August. However, what I can tell you is that the average person talks to Sergeant Starr for 16 minutes. Now, that is roughly four times as long as they would speak with a regular recruiter online. So in that sense, he's working extremely well. And the Army estimates that about 750 people are clicking on Sergeant Starr each day.
But what percentage of those clicking actually sign on?
Right. Well, it's difficult to say because how can we attribute it to, did I sign up directly because Sergeant Starr gave me this information, or was there another reason? So it's very hard to determine why someone ultimately chose to sign up.
All right, Jason Margolis, thank you for introducing us to Sergeant Starr. Thanks very much.
You're most very welcome. we're off to Italy for our next story, a little Italian folk music in the background. Scientists in Italy believe they've found a community where residents are immune to several common diseases. The people come from a village 3,000 feet above sea level in the foothills of the Dolomites. For those of you who don't know feet, 3,000 feet is about 1,000 meters. For several weeks of the year, the villagers there are cut off from the outside world, surrounded by deep snow. Scientists now believe that after living in isolation for so many generations, the villagers have developed a resistance that could provide a cure for the rest of us. From Italy, the BBC's correspondent Christian Fraser files this report.
High in the northeast mountains of Italy sits the alpine village of Stoccaredo. In the square, there's a war memorial that lists the men who died in the First World War. It looks like any other memorial, but on this one, all the names are the same. With the exception of just two men, both from a neighbouring hamlet, all those from Stoccaredo who died were called Bau. It's a highly unusual name, unless you live in Stoccaredo, because here, for some unbeknown reason, it's almost the only name in the village. In fact, of 400 people who live in Stoccaredo, 380 of them are called Bau.
In my family, we are all Baus. My parents, my grandparents, all Baus. And I married a Bau.
And Marika, who runs the bar in Stoccaredo, is quite typical. So isolated is the village that men have always tended to marry within the community, thus keeping the surname alive. It does, of course, create a certain amount of confusion, not least for the lady who delivers the post.
It's difficult delivering the post here. We do have a notebook that lists the names, but many times letters arrive just saying Maria Bau, and we have to work out which one it is. It's not easy.
According to local tradition, the name originated with seven Bau brothers of Germanic origin from either Saxony, Bavaria or Denmark. Until recently, the villagers here all spoke with a Germanic accent. At one time, there were seven Luigi Baus and 20 Maria Baus who all lived here at the same time. To make it easier, there's now an agreement among families that they'll call their children by different first names. Here in the town hall, there is this dusty old book in which you can trace the lineage of the Bau community all the way back to the 12th century. But aside from the name, there is something else that this current generation of Baus have in common, and that is an extremely high level of blood sugar. And yet, contrary to what you would expect in a community like this where that is the case, there's virtually no sign of heart disease or hypertension. Excited by this discovery, scientists have begun a study of the Bau community. They're testing blood pressure and taking samples. They believe this tolerance to heart disease could be down to an inherited gene.
We are not sure about this yet, but either the environment they live in, or maybe there's one gene or maybe more genes that is giving their particular resistance to heart disease, even if they have high cholesterol levels.
Dr. Uros Ladnik is a specialist in medical genetics at the Center of Rare Diseases in Vicenza. He and his team are comparing blood samples from the community with those taken from heart disease patients. They believe that because the Baus have always married within the community, the current generation is a unique gene pool.
And finding the gene that's involved in this could maybe lead to a cure or to a better cure for heart disease in people that don't have this particular gene. We could do some drugs that are targeted to this particular gene or the effect of this gene.
In the laboratory, the research is ongoing. They've mapped the entire family tree, which now sits on a computer database. The scientists are paying visits to the community every few months. They're still not sure whether the secret is in the genetic makeup of these people, but it's a fair chance.
All those villages, if they are older than 300 years, they tend to have some point in their history where there's an extremely low number of individuals that are let's say, building this population. And maybe only a family survived, and that family then repopulated the entire village.
In the local primary school, an entire classroom can trace their ancestry back to just 8 families. And of course, it's very likely they have a genetic program very similar to the people who first settled here. The challenge for modern science is finding out what it is.
What's your surname?
My surname is Bau.
And for our last story, we're going to take it back to the United States, back to New York City. Now, I'm wavering about whether this story is truly a technology story. Regardless, I think it's close enough, so I'm going for it. And I think it's engaging, it's a short story, I'm throwing it on the podcast. For anyone who's ever visited New York, you know there's a million and one ways to take a tour. You can take one of those bus tours throughout the entire city, walking tours of downtown, church tours of Harlem. Doesn't end. But a popular blog site is now offering a free olfactory tour. That's right, olfactory. That's a tour of smells. But this one isn't for the faint-hearted. Tara Gomitsky has been exploring New York subway's smell map, and this is what she uncovered.
The smell of home. I'm underground at the 2nd Avenue and Houston subway stop, just minutes from my apartment. Now, I've always known there was a particular smell to this station, but I never knew exactly what it was until I came across Gawker.com's map of subway smells. Turns out my subway station smells like inside the bowels of a very sick animal, and it also has undertones of tuberculosis in the smell. Now, Chris Mone is the managing editor of Gawker.com, the very popular blog here in New York. Chris, tell me about this map of subway smells.
Well, it got started because the way that the subway system smells is kind of a perennial favorite topic of conversation amongst New Yorkers who spend a significant portion of their time underground. And after seeing that kind of article resurrected every few months or so, we got the idea of asking our readers to submit smells of the subway stations that they spend the most time in. And we didn't really think about making a map at first, but we got several hundred responses, quite a few of which were very passionate and descriptive and colorful.
Well, let's see what another subway station smells like. We're going to go up to the subway stop that's closest to the BBC offices here. Okay, here we are at 34th Street and 8th Avenue subway station. The BBC studios are just down the street. This is a really busy stop, and it does have some strong smells here. I noticed, Chris, that some of your readers wrote quite imaginative descriptions. What do they say about this stop?
About this particular station, some people found that they could smell something dead and decaying, and someone else described it as a urine post-asparagus buffet.
But it's interesting because this sense of smell, it does trigger a lot of memories and emotions in people, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why we had such a strong reaction to our call for smell reports, because people smell these things every single day when they're commuting around in Manhattan, and they come to associate that with going to work or going home from work or having to be packed in with all these people they'd much rather not be spending their day with.
Well, let's experience one more station, because I want to see if it really is true that life is better on the other side of the track. So let's go to one of New York's wealthier neighborhoods. Okay, so here we are on 77th Street in the well-heeled Upper East Side neighborhood of Manhattan. What do your readers say about this station, Chris?
Here they reported baked bread, golden brown crust, cinnamon, butter, and other baked goods.
Nice. So in Manhattan, the rich even get better-smelling subway stations. But I have to say, it's not piped in just for their benefits. There's actually a bakery just above this station. I could use some of that in my neighborhood.
That's our show for the week. I'm going to be on the road all week next week in the Great White North up in Canada. So I'm afraid I'll be cut off from communication for much of the week and won't be able to put out the podcast. And the only person who could possibly put out the podcast in the whole world, pun intended, is my colleague Alex Galifant. But Alex is out gallivanting in Guatemala. for a few weeks, so unfortunately we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Any thoughts, comments, suggestions, or otherwise, my email address again is jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. That's jason.margolis@bbc.co.uk. Have a great week, and I'll be talking to you again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening. Yo guardo siempre tu querido nombre.